Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by John Calvert, holder of the Henry W. Casper S.J. Associate Professorship in History at Creighton, and author of Sayyid Qutb and the Origins of Radical Islamism. He'll speak on the topic, The Great War and the Making of the Modern Middle East. This program, co-sponsored by the Creighton University Reinhardt Alumni Memorial Library, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, March 19, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Deborah Sturgis, Head of Access Services at the Reinhardt Alumni Memorial Library at Creighton University.
Dr. John Calvert is a professor of history here at Creighton, where he focuses on modern Middle East history. Currently, he's working on a book which is a study of British responses to pan-Islam, 1880 to 1920. His most recent book, Sayyid Qutb and the Origins of Radical Islam, published by Columbia University Press, received recognition including reviews in the New York Review of Books and The Economist, and was listed as Best Book of 2010 by Foreign Policy, Outstanding Book in Middle East Studies by Atlantic Monthly, and as one of the best books of the year by The Guardian. He has been a consultant to the Canadian Refugee Board, The New Yorker Magazine, the United Arab Emirates, and the History Channel. We are very pleased to have Dr. John Calvert with us today.
Well, thank you, Deborah, for that very nice introduction, and thank all of you for being here this afternoon when I'm sure you have many other things you could have been doing. I really would like to thank the Reinhardt Alumni Library staff for calling attention to the Great War. We are at its centenary, and it really was a turning point in history. The world has never been the same since 1914. And I hope you've had an occasion to see the very fine posters that the library has put up in the windows and the book displays and so forth, which they change periodically just to keep them fresh. I don't know if you're going to be keeping this up for the duration of the centenary. Well, there you go. Last June, the jihadists of the Islamic State posted pictures online of one of their bulldozers crashing through the earthen burn that forms part of the frontier between Syria and Iraq. They announced that they were destroying the Sykes-Picot border. Now, the reference was to a 1916 agreement signed by Britain and France that divided the Arab provinces of the dying but not yet dead Ottoman Empire into French and British spheres of imperial influence. After the war, Britain and France acted on the Sykes-Picot Agreement, quite literally drawing lines in the sand. They created a number of new states, Syria, Iraq, Palestine, Transjordan, and Lebanon, that had no basis in history or geography, and which divided Arabs and Muslims from one another. The symbolic action by Islamic State fighters against a century-old imperial carve-up illustrates, I think, the pervasiveness in the region of the myth of a pre-colonial innocence, a time when the Ottoman Empire and Sunni Islam ruled over an unbroken realm from North Africa to the Gulf. Indeed, the Arabic name of ISIS, Ad-Dawla al-Islamiyya fi al-Iraq wa al-Sham, refers to the old Arab idea of the Greater Levant, the Bilad al-Sham, that transcends the region's modern Western-imposed state borders. So what I want to do today is talk about the circumstances that led to the creation of the modern Arab state system, how that system emerged from the rubble of the vanquished Ottoman Empire, and how many of the political problems that have plagued the Middle East in recent decades trace back to the war. I also want to call attention to the fact that the Great War was truly a global event that involved millions of people in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. This is perhaps an obvious point to make, given the conflict's unquestioned characterization as a world war, but it's sometimes forgotten, especially these days amid the flurry of commemorative activity that's taking place in northern France and Flanders. It's worth remembering, for example, that over 1 million Indian soldiers served overseas during the war, that it was the Algerian soldiers at Ypres who were the first in the war to be exposed to poison gas, that over 500,000 Syrian civilians died from disease and starvation in 1915, 1916, 1917, and that perhaps 1.5 million Armenians perished at the hands of the Ottoman regime in the 20th century's first genocide. 1908 is an appropriate year to begin our story. That year, the Ottoman Sultan Caliph, Abdulhamid II, was deposed by a radical reform group called the Committee of Union and Progress, or CUP, which was made up of mainly Turkish intellectuals, military officers, which had formed in Salonika. The CUP's avowed purpose was to shore up what was left of the Ottoman Empire, amalgamate its peoples, and strengthen it by means of progressive reforms. For two centuries, the Ottoman Empire had been in almost perpetual crisis. The great Ottoman carpet was being rolled up at both ends. In the west, the Austro-Hungarians chipped away at the empire's surviving territory in the Balkans. Just prior to the CUP's coup d'etat, the Austro-Hungarians had annexed Bosnia, much to the chagrin of Serbia, which viewed Bosnia as properly falling within its orbit. And of course, in 1914, it would be a Serbian assassin who assassinated the Austro-Hungarian heir to the throne, thus setting in motion the chain of events that ignited the World War. From the north, the Russians threatened the Dardanelles, the strategic strait that joined the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. It had long been Russia's ambition to gain unimpeded access to the Mediterranean by controlling the straits. Ultimately, Russia sought to capture Istanbul, the medieval Constantinople, and revive it as the seat of Eastern Christendom after centuries of Islamic rule. Among the CUP's strengthening efforts, I think two deserve special comment. In order to bind more effectively the empire's provinces to the imperial center, the CUP embarked on a thorough process of bureaucratic centralization, which included a new emphasis on conservative nationalism. And here they built on the work of intellectuals like Ziya Gökalp, whose concept of the Turkish nation resembled the German Volk, a natural nation above human volition, bound by the mystery of language and lore. Nationalism would unify the polyglot empire by enforcing the use of Turkish at the expense of other languages, including Arabic. Now, this policy was never fully implemented, but it did cause some apprehension in the Arab provinces, leading some Arabs, especially in Greater Syria, the Balad al-Sham, toward their own nascent forms of Arab nationalism, which usually took the form of small secret societies and which advocated decentralization and cultural autonomy rather than outright independence. The second thing the CUP did was to reinforce the Ottoman Empire's relations with Germany. In fact, the connection between the two had long been tight. In 1903, the Germans won the concession to build the great Berlin to Baghdad Railway, one of the great building projects of the 20th century, whose western segment, the Orient Express, would in time be popularized by Agatha Christie. Since the 1880s, the Germans had played a prominent role in modernizing the Ottoman army. Ottoman soldiers had gone to war in the Balkans armed with Mauser rifles. But the CUP took this relationship further by formally signing an alliance with Germany on 2nd of August 1914. It was a consequential decision on the part of the CUP because it meant that the Ottomans would be on the losing side in the war. Now, why should the CUP have made such a rash move? Sentimental attachment to Germany was not a sufficient cause. Basically, it came down to the Ottomans' desire for protection. They were confronted by an existential threat from Russia, and they thought it essential that they make an alliance with a European power that might protect them from the Tsar's ambitions. That ruled out France and Britain, who were Russia's allies. It left Germany. For their part, the Germans were very pleased with the alliance. It meant the possibility of opening a second front against their enemies. So on the 11th of December, 1914, the Ottomans officially declared war against the Entente. Now, almost immediately, the Sheikh al-Islam issued five fatawa, or juridical opinions, which called on Muslims around the world for jihad against the Entente powers. Now, traditionally, Muslims have distinguished between jihad as fard kifaya, a collective obligation undertaken by an army on behalf of other Muslims, and jihad as fard ayn, jihad is an obligation incumbent on all Muslims in circumstances where Islam is at risk. And it was this latter understanding of jihad that the Sheikh al-Islam pushed. Islam was under siege by the Entente powers, and it was the duty of Muslims around the world to respond. Should any Muslim die in battle, he promised him the status of martyr. 3 days later, the jihad proclamation was issued publicly in the name of the Sultan Caliph, Mehmed VI. Crowds with flags and banners strove through the Straits of Istanbul, calling for holy war. Translations rendered the proclamation to Arabic, Urdu, and Tartar. Actually, it was the Germans who pushed hardest for the jihad proclamation. Strategists in Berlin had discussed the scheme even before the war commenced. The idea was to awaken what they regarded as the inherent fanaticism of Islam in ways that were beneficial to German war aims. To provoke the whole Mohammedan world into wild revolt against the British, the French, and the Russian empires. Islam was to be the Germans' secret weapon. It seems that in 1914, the Germans had the idea that Muslims could easily be mobilized, co-opted, and made to act in a uniform way. There are people in the West these days who believe similarly. All I'll say is that it wasn't true then, and it's not true today. Now, the Germans had many plans for the actual implementation of the jihad, the most detailed of which was written by Max von Oppenheim, who is the scion of a Jewish banking dynasty and an official in the German Foreign Office. He was a self-taught archaeologist. It was von Oppenheim who excavated Tal Halaf in northern Syria in 1911, a site, by the way, which is currently in great danger due to the civil war in Syria. I've heard reports, which I hope are true, that the site is currently being guarded by Kurdish Peshmerga. Now, in his memorandum for the revolutionizing of the Islamic territories of our enemies, how's that for a title, von Oppenheim outlined a campaign to provoke religious violence in the Entente's colonies and imperial peripheries. And to this end, he sent German and Ottoman emissaries, including academic experts, Orientalists, Arabists, diplomats, throughout Africa and Asia to circulate pan-Islamist propaganda that drew on the language of jihad and martyrdom. One of the most interesting German efforts in this regard was a POW camp on the outskirts of Berlin. It was called Half Moon Camp. It sounds like a summer camp in Wisconsin. And there the Germans tried to turn Muslim soldiers who had fought for France and Britain and had been captured in battles like Neuve-Chapelle and Second Ypres into jihadists loyal to Germany. in the middle of this camp, von Oppenheim built a large wooden mosque to show the Muslim inmates that the Germans were the true friends of Islam. And after they were indoctrinated and trained, he sent them on missions to places as far afield as Afghanistan. Well, it was only natural that the specter of jihad should have terrified government officials in Paris, London, and St. Petersburg. For decades, they had been haunted by the specter of Islamic insurgency in the Muslim-populated parts of their empires. And now it seemed that their worst fears were about to be realized. The last thing the French wanted was a Muslim uprising on the northwest frontier in India. The last thing the French wanted was the Saharan uprising. The Russians feared Muslim insurgency in the Caucasus. But the jihad did not take off the way that the Germans and the Ottomans had hoped. The Muslim world was simply too heterogeneous, too varied, and Muslim interests too localized for the call to have any sustained or uniform effect. Many Muslims, of course, saw straight through Germany's self-interested manipulation. They saw that the call to jihad was uneven and that it targeted kuffar, disbelievers, in three Western countries, but excluded three others, Germany, Bulgaria, and Austria-Hungary. Still, there was some jihadist agitation. For example, the militant Senussi Brotherhood made inroads into British Egypt. Some Indian Muslims made vociferous calls for an end to the Raj. All of this was just enough to keep the Entente nervous and on edge. Now, in retrospect, the Ottoman military effort was extraordinary. The Ottomans entered the war exhausted after 6 years of uninterrupted fighting in the Balkans. In the campaigns of 1912, 1913 alone, they had lost some 40,000 troops in Thrace and Macedonia. And so, with grim determination, the CUP set about overhauling production and communication facilities. It imposed conscription and forced many Christian and Jewish subjects of the empire into labor battalions. Zionist settlers in Palestine with Russian passports were identified as enemies of the state and were either confined or expelled from the land. In some cases, these Jews were forced to return to the hated Russian motherland. In all of these efforts, the Germans were aided by a host of German engineers, financial agents, economists, and especially military officers, some 25,000 of them. Now, despite their best efforts, the Ottomans got off to a rough start in the war. In December 1914, Enver Pasha, one of the architects of the 1908 CUP coup d'etat, launched his Third Army against the Russians in the highland border region between the Tsarist and Ottoman empires. His goal was to penetrate the Caucasus and incite the Turkic Khans of Russian Central Asia to rebellion. It was an audacious plan, and one made worse by the fact that the attack was launched in the dead of winter. At Sarkamesh, the site of the main battle, the Ottoman forces were caught in the snowy mountain passes without proper kit. Some 80,000 men were lost to the cold and to wounds incurred during the battle. So almost an entire Ottoman army was wiped out. Now, the Ottomans were quick to blame the defeat on the Christian Armenian population in eastern Anatolia, elements of which had been struggling for independence in the same manner as had Greek and Slavic Christians in the Balkans. The Armenians, of course, constitute the oldest Christian collectivity or nation in the world, dating to the 3rd century of the Common Era. The Ottomans claimed that during the Sarkamesh battle, the Armenians had aided and abetted the Russian enemy. Now, there was some truth to the charge of Armenian connivance. Local Armenians did provide military intelligence and logistical support to the Russian army. Yet the Ottoman response was wildly out of proportion to the charge. In order to make the entire region of eastern Anatolia safe for the Ottoman army, and at the same time eradicate the nuisance of Armenian nationalism altogether, the CUP made the decision to forcibly remove the Armenian population from the sensitive areas. Now, Turkish officials, as many of you are aware, have claimed that the ensuing deaths of hundreds of thousands of Armenians were circumstantial. Yes, they say, there were forced marches, death marches, if you like. There were many massacres. But the CUP officials were not Nazi-style desk murderers. They had no intention to implement genocide. I think, however, that the weight of historical evidence suggests otherwise and points to organized, purposeful mass killing. He traveled the byways of eastern Anatolia, as I've done on a couple of occasions, and it's clear that even the memory of the Armenian people has been expunged from the land. I remember hiring a local Turkish individual to take me to this island in Lake Van where stood this ancient Armenian church. And he was unable to tell me who built it. Never really heard of the Armenians. The Ottomans were more successful in their defensive endeavors. This is not surprising given that in the First World War, defending troops, whether in the Western Front or in the Middle Eastern theater, always had the advantage over attackers on account of military innovations like deep trenches, barbed wire, and machine guns. Besides that, in these battles, the Ottomans had their backs to the wall. They were defending their own territory. The most significant of the Ottoman defensive encounters was fought against British, French, and Dominion forces at the Dardanelles. As soon as the Ottomans entered the war on the side of Germany, Winston Churchill, the first Lord of the Admiralty, concocted a plan to storm the Dardanelles with warships, occupy Istanbul, and knock the Ottomans out of the war. Britain, Churchill said, would then be in a position to supply its faltering Russian ally through the Black Sea and attack the Austro-Hungarians and Germans through the Balkans. It was a plan that really seemed foolproof. The only person who sort of desisted was Admiral Fisher. Now, the naval attack began in February 1915, but almost immediately broke up when the British lost several ships to underwater mines and to shells fired from the heavy guns that the Ottomans had sighted along the high shores. Forced back to the drawing board, the British then decided to support the naval forces with troop landings in the Gallipoli Peninsula in order to neutralize the big guns. Thousands of British and Anzacs gathered in Egypt for the short voyage across the Mediterranean. But the element of surprise had been lost. The Ottomans had ample time to prepare their defenses. And as a result, the two British and Anzac landings at the Gallipoli Peninsula, one in April, the other in August 1915, and these are the largest amphibious assaults in history prior to D-Day, ended in disaster. After several months of hard and fruitless fighting, the British decided to evacuate their forces. Taken as a whole, the Dardanelles campaign was Britain's most decisive defeat of the entire World War. The campaign had cost them and the Ottomans over 500,000 casualties. Of course, as is well known, I think, for Australians, Gallipoli was more than simply a defeat. It was also an act of creation, the moment when a strong sense of Australian nationhood was born. Texans remember the Alamo. Australians and New Zealanders remember the sacrifices made by their troops at Gallipoli. It was on the pebbly beaches and rugged cliffs of the Gallipoli Peninsula that the Anzac legend was born. Anzac, of course, standing for Australian New Zealand Army Corps. In fact, the centenary of the first Gallipoli landing is fast approaching. It's going to be commemorated in just over 3 weeks on April 25th, the date of the initial landings. And so great has been the interest that the Australian government is managing attendance at the Anzac commemorations through a public lottery, which has long been closed. Well, all of this is to say that by late 1915, things were not going very well for the British in the Middle East. They had suffered catastrophic defeat at the Dardanelles, also in Mesopotamia, another campaign I could talk about. And in Istanbul, the Sultan Caliph was threatening their hold over the largely Muslim populations of India and Egypt by his proclamation of jihad. And it was then, when things were bleakest, that a Kurdish soldier who was in the Ottoman forces at Gallipoli, a guy named Mohammed al-Faruqi, defected to the British side during a routine mission across the lines to exchange dead and wounded. Transferred to Cairo, al-Faruqi told British intelligence that the nascent Arab nationalist movement that I talked about earlier was strong and it was waiting for an opportunity to assert itself against the Ottomans. Now, this was news that excited the British Middle East Command in Cairo. Here was an opportunity to cripple the Ottomans by stimulating an internal rebellion. But with whom should they align? The Arab secret societies were largely unknown to the British, and in any case, largely out of reach. It was then that they remembered the Sharif Hussein, the Hashemite emir of Mecca in the Hejaz, with whom they had been in sporadic contact since 1915. Now, the British thought the Sharif to be a good bet. He had prestige. He was a Sharif. This is an honorific title that denoted descent from the Prophet Muhammad and his clan of Hashim. And he was emir, or prince of Mecca. He looked after the holy mosques in Mecca and Medina on behalf of the Ottomans, made sure that the pilgrimage each year took place without a hitch. In the British view, he was uniquely qualified to rally the Arabs under the flag of Islam and thereby neutralize the Sultan Caliph's call for jihad. Now, in their overtures to the Sharif, the British hinted that they might even support him in a bid for the caliphate, should he desire the office. So like the Germans, the British were interested in harnessing the alleged mystic power of Islam for their own imperial purposes. Now, for his part, the Sharif showed interest in the British invitation to revolt. For a long time, he had been unhappy with the Ottomans. In pre-war days, he had more or less run his own show in Hejaz. But now the CUP was trying to put him on a short leash. Remember that the CUP officials were avid centralizers. They're trying to shore up the empire. The Sharif watched with trepidation as the Hejaz Railway, this was a branch line of the Berlin-Baghdad Railway, inched towards Mecca. He well understood that this railway could quickly bring Ottoman troops into the region to curtail any autonomy that he might have. Well, in letters he wrote to the British High Commissioner in Egypt, a fellow named Sir Henry McMahon, the Sharif wrote that he was attracted to the idea of becoming caliph. He said also that he would consider rebelling against his overlord, the Sultan Caliph, but only if the British promised to sponsor the creation after the war of an independent Arab state, which his own Hashemite family would govern. Ideally, this state should include all of the eastern Arabic-speaking regions in the Middle East, minus Egypt, which is under British occupation, and those territories in the peninsula, such as Aden and Kuwait, that were already under forms of British protection. The Sharif Hussein was at core a Dinist. He wasn't an Arab nationalist, but he was aware of the Arab nationalist movement in Syria, and he saw benefit in hitching his wagon to its cause. McMahon replied to the Sharif that what he requested was indeed doable, quite possible, but with conditions. McMahon said that Britain could not guarantee the Hashemites control of coastal Syria because their very good allies, the French, had dibs on that territory. Nor could the British guarantee the Hashemites control of Mesopotamia because the British had discovered oil at Masjid-i Suleiman in 1908, just across the frontier in southwest Persia, and because Mesopotamia cut across Britain's lines of communication with its Indian Empire. But the rest, yes, he could have it. Now, these conditions were not entirely satisfactory to the Sharif Hussein, but the vague promise made by the British of eventual Arab statehood was enough to get him on board. He assumed that negotiations with the British would continue once the Ottomans were defeated, and he would get coastal Syria and Mesopotamia, and the Hashemites would be lords over the region. And so in June 1916 began the famous Arab revolt against the Ottoman Turks. Almost immediately, the British and French began to pour weapons and money into the revolt, as 25,000 or so desert warriors haltingly made their way northward out of Hejaz toward Aqaba and Palestine, where they would cover the right flank of British General Edmund Allenby's expeditionary force as it advanced out of Egypt. The ultimate goal of the Arab army was to capture Damascus, the hallowed capital of the medieval Umayyad Caliphate, and so lay claim to Syria. However, the Hashemite advance was made without assistance from the Arab nationalist movement that the Ottoman deserter Al-Faruqi had touted, because by the time the revolt began, the Ottoman governor in Syria, Jamal Pasha, had discovered and eradicated the secret cells. So the Hashemites and their immediate allies in the peninsula were on their own. But again, not without British assistance. The British also sent liaison officers to help the Hashemites coordinate their efforts, one of whom was the famous T.E. Lawrence, whom the American journalist Lowell Thomas would soon make famous as Lawrence of Arabia. Now, Lawrence was a logical choice for the job. In pre-war days, as a student at Jesus College, Oxford, he had traveled around Syria on foot in order to research his honors thesis on the influence of Crusader castles on European military architecture. At the time, his thesis was regarded as a pioneering work of scholarship. Later, Lawrence joined with Leonard Woolley to excavate the Hittite city of Carchemish in northern Syria, right in the heart of ISIS territory. And during these excavations, he and Woolley also spied on the local Ottoman garrison on behalf of British intelligence. The Ottomans and German engineers were constructing a great railway bridge over the Euphrates right next to the site of Carchemish. And Lawrence and Woolley were there to see precisely what was going on and report back to the British. So here was someone fairly unique. Lawrence was highly educated. He was intellectually brilliant, physically strong, and he was familiar with Arab culture and the Arabic language, at least to the point of being able to hold a conversation. But his real genius lay in his ability to adapt traditional styles of Arab warfare to the task at hand. Whereas British officers favored discipline, order, and routine, and thought of war in terms of big armies, concentrated firepower, pitched battles against the enemy's main forces, the Arabs saw war as tentative, a game of hit and run. Lawrence used gold and guns, British gold and guns, to turn the medieval tradition of desert raiding into a modern insurgency. And here is a quote from Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Suppose we were, as we might be, an influence, an idea, a thing intangible, without front or back, drifting about like gas. Armies were like plants, immobile, firm-rooted, nourished through long stems to the head. We might be a vapor, blowing where we listed. The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, of course, is one of the great classics of English literature. It's a literary rendering of the Arab revolt, some 700 pages long. And I must confess, I've never sort of read the book cover to cover. I've always got bogged down on about page 400 or so. But it's a beautiful book, written in exemplary prose. Among Lawrence's key principles were to strive to win hearts and minds, to establish an unassailable base, to remain strategically dispersed. The key was to operate in small local groups, in depth rather than in lines, and strike only when the enemy could be taken by surprise. Lawrence took to wearing the robes of a Hashemite sheikh. He said that this Arab dress was more decent in the harsh condition of the desert. And also the Arabs knew better how to take him. This clothing ingratiated him to the Arabs, just as it alienated him from his fellow British officers. They believed that Lawrence was demeaning himself by dressing in Arab robes. Lawrence, of course, was not the first proponent of modern guerrilla warfare, but he was the first to transform it into a coherent theory. I mean, you look at the Chindits, you look at the long-range desert group, you look at the SAS, all of these are the offspring of the Arab revolt. Now, it was while the Arab revolt was in full progress that Georges Picot and Marc Sykes met secretly to divide the Arab regions of Greater Syria and Mesopotamia between France and Britain. By this Sykes-Picot agreement, France was to control directly coastal Syria and a large region of eastern Anatolia. France here put itself forward as the protector of the remnants of the Armenian population. At the same time, as I've indicated, France had long-standing interests going back to the time of the Crusades in coastal Syria, and so wanted to rule that particular territory directly. France was to have indirect control in Region A, the hinterland, the interior region of Syria. Perhaps France would rule through a native prince over this particular territory. Britain, on the other hand, was to have direct, unmediated control over Mesopotamia, the region stretching from Basra at the head of the Gulf up to Baghdad, and was to control Area B, the inland region, indirectly, again, perhaps through a native prince. Palestine was to be internationalized in ways that weren't really sort of fleshed out in detail. But this was sort of done as a sop to Russia. Russia sort of saw itself as the protector of the holy places in Palestine, in Jerusalem in particular. And so France and Britain threw the Russians a bone by internationalizing Palestine, saying it should be internationalized after the war. The Russians didn't want the country to fall under the hegemony of any one particular country. Now, this Sykes-Picot agreement was secret, but it was made public by the Bolsheviks in late 1917. Rifling through the Tsarist archives, the Bolsheviks found a copy of the Sykes-Picot agreement, and they published it. In fact, waved it in the face of the Hashemites. See what these nasty imperialists have done behind your back. You are fighting on a lie. You have been punked. you think you're fighting for an independent Arab state. Ha! France and Britain are going to divide this region between them after the war. They're going to cut you out. Well, the Sharif Hussein and his son Faisal, who was the field commander of the Arab Revolt, were devastated, brokenhearted, in fact. But the Arab Revolt was too far along to call it back. And I think the Hashemites were hoping that once the war was won, the British and the French might reconsider and grant the Hashemites the promise that had been made them by the British in 1915, early 1916. Britain made one more advance booking during the war. This is the Balfour Declaration of 1917, by which Great Britain promised to facilitate the creation of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Now, I think the British were interested in facilitating Zionism for three reasons. Number one, they wanted to win worldwide Jewish support for the British war effort. They especially were interested in gaining support of American Jews, hoping that they would put pressure on Woodrow Wilson to get involved in the war sooner rather than later. I think they're also hoping that the Jews in the Austro-Hungarian and German empires might see fit to cooperate with the Entente. So it was a way of gaining worldwide Jewish support for the British war effort. A second reason was geostrategic. The British, of course, were occupying Egypt. They were keen to protect the Suez Canal, their lifeline to the British Empire. Wouldn't it be nice to have a friendly Jewish state on the right flank of the canal, a Jewish state that would protect British interests in the region? And I think the third reason is more difficult to pin down or identify and relates to the romantic and religious sentiments of certain British statesmen. I mean, it is a fact that Lord Balfour said that he knew the map of biblical Israel better than he did the map of contemporary France. People like Lloyd George, Arthur Balfour, were members of the Church of England. They believed in the Bible, and the idea of bringing the Jews home to their ancestral land appealed to them viscerally. It wasn't something that they enunciated explicitly, but it was a sentiment that propelled them, I think, in that direction. As historians, we always have to be alert to the role of predisposition and sentiment in the formation of international policy and so forth. There are emotions bubbling beneath the surface that often determine how historical actors behave. Well, this is quite a mess, isn't it? The British are making promises all over the place to various parties. And Britain has often been criticized for its duplicity, its manipulation of various parties, especially the Hashemites. But the British, at least the Foreign Office, I must say that the Arab Bureau in Cairo was interested in fulfilling. The Arab Bureau, of course, included T.E. Lawrence, was interested in fulfilling the promise that Britain had made to the Hashemites during the war. They sort of foresaw the creation of what they called a brown dominion, Arab dominion, to stand beside the white dominions of Australia and Canada, a dominion that would be steered benevolently to independence by the British. But the British Foreign Office was interested in placating France. And it was the British Foreign Office that really sort of pushed the Sykes-Picot agreement. But all British, whether belonging to the Arab Bureau or the Foreign Office, believed that the contradictions between the Hussein-McMahon promise and the Sykes-Picot agreement were not all of that severe. You know, superimpose Hussein-McMahon on Sykes-Picot, and the discrepancies aren't that great. You'll recall that in Hussein-McMahon, Britain said to the Hashemites they probably couldn't have coastal Syria or Mesopotamia. And sure enough, in Sykes-Picot, those particular territories are to come under direct French and British control. I think the British believed also that those areas of indirect control in Sykes-Picot should have satisfied the Hashemites' aspirations for statehood. yes, the French and the British would sort of be there in the background, would perhaps govern Arab princes as puppets and so forth, but only for the short term, and eventually the Arabs in that particular region would have their full independence. Well, I'll just conclude by talking a little bit about the legacy of this Sykes-Picot Agreement. It acting on the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the British ended up creating all of those states that I talked about at the beginning of this talk. At the San Remo Conference in 1920, French and British officials rolled out maps, took out rulers and pencils, and created states that roughly approximated the earlier agreement in Sykes-Picot. And those states have persisted to the present moment. But their legitimacy has always been challenged because in almost every case, rulership was taken up by a particular clique or ethnic group at the expense of others. So, for example, in Iraq, the British set Faisal, the son of the Sharif Hussein, up as king of the country. He had no relation to Mesopotamia. He was a native of Hejaz, but he was more or less airlifted into Baghdad and made king under the aegis of the British. And so we have a Sunni king and ruling establishment governing a majority Shia population. And that sort of configuration persisted until 2003, when Saddam Hussein was deposed by the Americans and the British. And sectarian warfare has been the result. Lebanon, you know, was created by the French for the benefit of the Maronite Christians. They ended up dominating the politics of that country, again at the expense of the larger Muslim populations. In Syria, the Alawis eventually took control of the state. And, of course, their authority is currently being contested by a variety of Sunni groups, some of them jihadi in orientation. So I think, you know, that the Sykes-Picot Agreement has had sort of quite a legacy in the region. States were created that had no sort of basis in history or geography, that cut across tribal, ethnic, religious lines, that ended up being dominated by a particular group. We see here sort of a recipe for disaster. But it also left a legacy of bitterness against the West. You ask any Arab schoolchild from Aleppo or Damascus about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and they'll be able to tell you exactly what it was about. This is the first sort of time when the West betrayed the Arabs, you know. The first of many examples of Western betrayal. The whole sort of term Sykes-Picot has a bitter taste in Arab mouths. And I would say that it's a treaty that most Americans have never heard of. I think I'll leave it there, and we can sort of open the floor to questions. We've got about 10 minutes left. There's lots more to talk about. And I would ask you, if you do have a question, to please come to the microphone that's placed in the aisle.
What do you think of the whole movement these days in terms of trying to keep Iraq as a unified country, which, of course, is very artificial, as you've kind of pointed out, rather than to seek maybe more natural divisions?
Well, I think it all depends on politics. You know, unless the Shia government in Baghdad becomes more inclusive, the sectarian conflict will persist, and the issue of ISIS will continue. I think if you have an inclusive polity in Baghdad, then there's every opportunity for Iraq to, you know, maintain its territorial integrity. But if, you know, in exclusive politics become the norm, as they seem to be currently, then perhaps we will see the country fracture into perhaps three segments. The Kurds, of course, already have their own state in the north. You know, they're independent in all but sort of name. But it'll be very interesting to see what the map of the Middle East looks like in 10 years' time. I mean, borders could well, you know, be redrawn.
How might have the region evolved had it not been for European intervention during and after World War I?
It's very interesting to speculate. You know, could the Ottoman Empire have survived, you know, well into the 20th century? I mean, it's possible. You know, perhaps the Sultanate might have transformed into some type of constitutional monarchy and so forth. Perhaps, you know, a decentralized sort of polity might have developed where the Arabs might have had control over their own political affairs, but shared sort of, you know, federal policy with Turks and so forth. It's also interesting to speculate that such a neo sort of Ottoman realm would probably be very wealthy because they would be in control of the Gulf oil. So, you know, Istanbul, you know, might be this sort of petro center, you know, full of, you know, shiny sort of tall buildings containing oil companies and so forth. It might have been a real sort of power in the world, you know, the Ottomans had the empire survived. But this is, you know, rash speculation.
I was wondering, could you elaborate on what happened in Versailles, perhaps? Was there any redemption, perhaps, or did things just get worse?
Well, you know, I mean, so many African and Asian leaders heeded U.S. President Woodrow Wilson's call for the self-determination of nations, and they gathered at Versailles to make their cases. I mean, Ho Chi Minh was there. Saad Zaghloul, the Egyptian leader, attempted to go to Paris to argue the case for Egypt's independence. And the Emir Faisal was there, the Hashemite, the field commander of the Arab revolt, the son of the Sharif Hussein. Now, Emir Faisal was not a rude Bedouin. He was a sophisticated individual. He had spent his pre-war years in Istanbul. He read newspapers. He was aware of the world. And he was there in Paris with T.E. Lawrence and other leaders of the Arab revolt to try and convince the delegates that Britain should, you know, honor its commitment to the Hashemites. But at every turn, Faisal was rebuked, ignored. Even the Americans wouldn't give him the time of day. And that's because France and Britain were pressing their case. They were insistent that the Sykes-Picot Agreement, or at least a version thereof, be implemented. And I think there was also a general understanding amongst the Western nations that the Arabs were not ready for any type of independence. They required the expert tutelage that only countries like France and Britain could provide. And in fact, the League of Nations allowed France and Britain to govern those new states that they had created, provided they do so as mandates. You know, the word mandate comes from the Latin, mando mandare mandatum. It means to put something in somebody's hand, to entrust somebody with something. And perhaps Professor Habash would applaud my attempt at Latin. And so, you know, according to the League of Nations, France and Britain had the responsibility of developing these new states politically and economically. And once they attained a certain level of development, France and Britain were to leave and grant those countries their independence. But I think there's a general consensus that that was sometime in the future.
To what extent were Britain and France opposing each other when they're carving up the Middle East, or were they entirely in concert the whole time? It didn't look like that from what you implied.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think the Foreign Office, you know, it's a question of one hand not doing what the other was up to. The Foreign Office was interested in placating France. France had suffered heavily in the Western Front. France had a legitimate historical claim in Syria. And I think the Foreign Office was keen to allow France to have its territory in Syria. But again, British officials in Egypt, attached to the Arab Bureau in particular, including T.E. Lawrence, didn't want France to have any part of Syria. And that's why sort of Lawrence was very keen for the Hashemite Arabs to capture Damascus, so that the Arabs could sort of, you know, make a case and then, you know, have the British sort of mentor them, tutor them benevolently to some type of independence. So there was quite a bit of friction between the French and some elements in the British political establishment over the peace treaties and final configuration, political configuration of Syria. Well, thank you very much then.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by John Calvert, holder of the Henry W. Kasper S.J. Associate Professorship in History at Creighton, and author of Saeed Qutob and the Origins of Radical Islamism. He spoke on the topic, The Great War and the Making of the Modern Middle East. This program, co-sponsored by the Creighton University Reinert Alumni Memorial Library, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, March 19, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.